Welcome to High Velocity Radio. This is your host, Stone Payton, and joining me in the studio this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Mr. Stone, how was your weekend?
It was nice. I'm getting jazzed about this week. You know, we have July 4th coming up. Going to take a little bit of time and celebrate our independence. And I think I have a new segment for our show.
And it's what is that?
It's the inspiration moment. Because
moment of inspiration.
Moment of inspiration. You're always better with the marketing
piece. A
little
elegant.
It's the copywriter coming out in you. So, you know, on the drive from my home to the studio, I probably pass a dozen churches. And I'm always on the lookout for the smart aleck stuff they say on those church signs.
Right.
And the first church I pass is actually mine. It's like a block away from that house. And it said, life does not have a remote, so get up and change it yourself.
You like that?
I like that. Do you think that's quotable?
That's something.
So what was your weekend like?
Tried some new restaurants.
Yeah.
But most importantly, I was working with our friend Michael Blake, who was at Startup Lounge, and he is in charge of the TechCrunch event next week, and he invited us to do a remote there.
Well, you know what I'm excited about. Of course, I like Michael. I always enjoy doing the remote broadcast, and that's a fun crowd, but the location is what's got me excited.
Yes, it's the Sweetwater Brewery. For those who have never been there, I'm sure a lot of you have.
So that's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be in the evening. It's going to be at the brewery. It's called TechCrunch. I'm not that familiar with TechCrunch. You're more in the know on this stuff than
yes,
I am.
Somebody I know, John Biggs, is the editor of the TechCrunch blog, and he has been for a long time. He was the editor when it was a Michael Arrington blog, and then it was purchased by AOL / Huffington Post, and then Michael Arrington was booted out of the blog.
Sorry,
and now
Michael.
Now it is AOL, Huffington Post blog. But he's still the editor, John.
Okay, so the restaurants. Let's get the quick review. What'd you
yes,
find?
Yes, the restaurant, number one, Mexican, inside of a Mexican grocery store, Three Hermanos.
If what you, is Hermanos? Three Hermans?
Brothers.
Oh,
brothers.
Good. Nice. I didn't do so well with the languages.
Obviously. And Pensacola, the Spanish program there is lacking a little bit.
A little bit. Underfunded.
And, that's authentic. They don't speak English. Totally authentic.
It's the real deal.
You got to figure it out. And the other one was an Italian market in Buckhead, right by Piedmont and Roswell Road. Really good. A family-owned, old people work there. It's a classic. Got the grandmother, got the everybody.
So you're refreshed, recharged, well-fed, and you're
yes.
ready to get to work, right?
Exactly. Now it's time for the important stuff.
Well, no, this is going to be a fun show, and I just want to say right up front, I'm not the shortest person in the studio today.
Yes, because someone brought a child.
He's not a child. He's a young man, and he's a travel ball player. So, and a little bit later in the program, we are going to hear from both Adam Ross with Social Vest, Maury Mogul with Pyramid Consulting, and his son Austin, who plays travel ball, but I don't know who he represents. We'll have to find out who his sponsors are a little bit later in the program. But first up on High Velocity Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce a gentleman who we met not too long ago in the hot seat, man. It was at a remote broadcast. Put
Startup
him on the spot.
Lounge. Startup Lounge, yeah.
Asked him the tough questions. He came through like a champ.
And he still wanted to come
back. And he still wanted to come into the studio. You believe that? Please welcome to the Business Radio X studio and back to the Business Radio Mike Esquire Clint Crosby. Welcome, man.
Thanks very much, guys. Thanks for having me back again.
We are delighted to have you. So you're with Baker, Donaldson, Behrman?
Bierman, Caldwell.
Bierman, Caldwell, and Berkowitz.
Yes, sir.
And is there room on this card for Crosby at some point?
Give me a few more years. If this practice development works, then perhaps. But one day it'll be Baker Donaldson, but that may take a little while.
So tell us a little bit about this practice, and maybe a good place to start is why did you find yourself at Startup Lounge? Give us a little bit of a feel for what you're up to.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an intellectual property lawyer by trade, a patent attorney, do a lot of trademark, both prosecution, litigation, patent litigation, and so what has happened is a lot of my clients are those entrepreneurs, those small startup companies, maybe, you know, technology companies in the, you know, up to $5 or $10 million. And so we found ourselves running amongst the entrepreneurs, if you will. And so we looked for opportunities to, you know, market our services and see how we can help the startup community here in Atlanta. Because certainly, with, you know, as you mentioned, TechCrunch, Startup Lounge, you know, there's a lot of things going on in Atlanta with startups and entrepreneurs. So we've really kind of packaged a set of services to target that group. And so we wanted to do some sponsorships. So we're working with Startup Lounge. We're working with MIT Enterprise Forum, We'll be at Venture Atlanta in October. So it was kind of a startup lounge is one of those great events to get out to. It's a complete, you know, the complete free form mingle, which I always enjoy because the first time attendees are kind of looking around like lost puppies waiting for the, you know, the itinerary of what's supposed to happen. And so,
I like that phrase, free form mingle.
Because it really is, you know, different than a lot of events.
Right.
It's like grab a drink and meet some people. So and as you mentioned, you know, Mike Blake does a great job with that. So we've really had a good time getting to meet some folks there. And really, it's interesting how few have thought of the legal side of what they're doing and the assistance they may need. So, you know, I feel like we're able to provide that, you know, quick 5-minute free consultation there and get them at least exposed to what they may need down the road.
Now, something that really caught my attention when we talked at Startup Lounge was that your firm has decided to really invest in this area, and you've created kind of a program or a platform that's geared towards the startup.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we really kicked this off hard probably about 2 years ago, and we have, you know, in the firm, we call it our emerging companies team. You know, everything needs a name in a law firm. And then the program, we call it our Emerging Companies Institute. And what that is, you know, we call it a package set of services for the, you know, startup new business to really take them from formation all the way through up and operation for a flat fee. You know, as you guys know, one of the biggest concerns about legal services is the cost.
It's the creep.
Yeah, it's the creep. good point. And so what we provide is the predictability. So you're not just worried about that attorney with the, you know, whatever hourly rate. You understand that you're in for a package and you know what's in that package.
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that's important to me about that program and what I like so much about it is that you're not afraid to make a call. Like every time I call my lawyer, in the back of my head, I'm doing the math of how much this is costing me and I'm looking at the clock.
Absolutely.
And this is a totally different way of doing business, I think.
Yeah, I mean, because we provide, you know, there's basically, I don't bill my clients for those calls, you know, that are in the program. I mean, I think there's a set amount of time that we state, you know, per month, but we typically go over that. And so, you know, in inquiring about the documents, the agreements, anything like that, you know, again, there's no additional charge for any of those pieces. And then one of the things we've been doing here is, we call it our Entrepreneur Minute, where we've been filming at some locations, both some of our attorneys, some entrepreneurs, some other service providers, kind of to put out, you know, hey, these are some things that startups need to think about. And we send those out about once a month, I suppose. We filmed them in Nashville. We filmed them in New Orleans. We'll be filming here in Atlanta soon. And we've got a lot of value out of that, a lot of real return where actual entrepreneurs get on the air and say, hey, this is something you need to be concerned about. I did one on what happens if you get sued. You know, every attorney kind of can answer those questions, but some people don't realize, hey, if the sheriff shows up at my door, here's what I need to do. But we've had a lot of success with this, you know, program, a lot of people getting involved. And again, you know, there's some companies we work with, they may already be formed. They may have their LLC or their corporation, something like that. And so what we can do is, you know, we can package another slate of services for them, you know, and again, give them that predictability of what it's going to cost going forward.
How early should someone consider engaging you? Is it straight from the idea on the cocktail napkin, or is it after when should they reach out?
That idea at the cocktail napkin on the napkin is really great, because at that point we can provide that initial guidance to kind of keep folks out of trouble. Because if they do a proper corporate formation, if they have a proper shareholder agreement, if they have proper business development agreements, that eliminates a lot of the long-term risk for these companies. And most of these guys, at some point, they want to liquidate the company. They want to sell it out. They want to, you know, cash out and move on. And the first thing that's going to happen when that investor, you know, be it venture capital, angel capital, or a total buyout, they're going to want to look at the books. They're going to want to look at the operating agreement. They're going to want to see the intellectual property and know that it's protected. And so what we're able to do is kind of give that guidance in advance and answer some of those questions so that folks are heading down the right road. Because you get some of these guys pretty young out of Georgia Tech. They know they have a lot of ideas, but they don't understand inventorship and the patent context and things like that, that really can be big issues down the road.
So having some scar tissue and having started a company or two that may not have done as well as I had hoped, it's a slam dunk to me. I wouldn't think of not calling you if I were starting a new company. But I got to envision some of these folks, they don't understand the value. Do they ever Do they ever say no, or what kind of reasons do they give for saying, I'm not ready yet? Or
I think most of them feel that, it's either too early in the process, or going back to what we talked about earlier, they're just scared of the cost. And so
that's really big to this predictability of the cost thing.
Right? I think it very much is. And, you know, and even with my existing clients, I joke with all of them, hey, once a quarter, whatever, call me up, let's go to lunch. You know, I'll buy the lunch. I'll give you all the free legal advice you can get, you know, within the span of an hour and a half lunch. And I didn't think that was that novel of an idea, but the clients love it. And typically as an attorney, you come away with something from that. You know, it may not be an immediate, hey, we need to open a file on this, but probably at some point they're going to call you and need some sort of service out of that. I mean, so, you know, it's certainly a two-way street, but just to sit there and answer some questions. I mean, it may be, hey, we're going to lease some new space. You know, who do we need to talk to do that? You know, what do we need to be concerned about? Or I've got this employee. I don't think things are going very well with this employee. How do I need to structure this in order to help them out the door? And we can answer all those questions. And that really just gives them, you know, gives them a lot of comfort. And so I think that, you know, I try and use that to tell folks, you know, don't worry about picking up the phone and asking some questions. You know, you're going to be fine. We can walk you through this, and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars. And ideally, it keeps you from getting sued later or having to sue somebody later. And that's what does cost tens of thousands of dollars. So a little bit on the front end will save a lot on the back end.
Now, are there any kind of a missteps that you just see consistently that you're like, hey, you know, why do they all make the same mistake?
You know, we see it a lot in where somebody does have a patent, you know, with inventorship. They don't understand that, you know, we won't get too legal technical, but, you know, to put somebody's name on a patent application, they have to be an inventor. It can't be your buddy who is just in the company and has some skin in the game. It actually has to be an inventor. And the problem is a patent can be invalidated if you don't have proper inventorship. So you get some folks that are kind of, you know, willy-nilly filing patent applications that can really get them into trouble. An example we talked about before was, you know, the use of independent contractors. A lot of people do it to write code, you know, for one project or another. A lot of those independent contractor agreements state that the contractor owns the code. Well, that sets up a copyright problem. Then when you go to sell your code or sell your company, you don't own it, or you're a co-owner with your independent contractor. And so that can be, you know, a huge red flag, you know, when we get into to a company to take a look at them. You know, we've also seen companies that go to, they want to sell themselves, and you go look at their capitalization table, and you know they have distributed more shares than the corporation's actually issued. So you kind of you know the math doesn't add up.
So it's like that movie, The Producer.
Yeah, exactly. and that's why we tell everybody, hey, let's keep this on an Excel spreadsheet and let's track it. You know, and that's another piece of the ECI I don't think we've talked about, but we host all these documents on an extranet, so the client can come look at them at any time. They don't have to pay any money or make a phone call in order to do that. They just simply go on the extranet, they log in, and they take a look at all these documents. And then we know that they're there. They're not gathering dust in the corner of an office somewhere. So, you know, the client can have comfort. If they wake up in the middle of the night and want to know who's got shares of their company, they can log in and go look and see.
Well, I really applaud your novel. I do think it's novel. I think it's unique, and you've really essentially declared leadership in this space of serving emerging companies. Still must be a real challenge, though, to wade through all of the possibilities and generate the right kinds of conversations with the right kinds of potential clients. So how are you getting them into your world, or how are you getting into their world?
You know, it's a lot of it is what we mentioned earlier, kind of the circulation, you know, into Startup Lounge, the MIT Enterprise Forum, you know.
Working those events, doing yeah, that. You drink a lot of cheap beer, don't you?
This is the truth, absolutely.
Do you try to nurse like that one drink all night?
So exactly, that one $4 Heineken. And really, that gets us that exposure, because what's interesting is you come out to do this and launch this program, and there's not anybody else that's doing it in Atlanta that we have seen.
Right.
And so a lot of folks, you know, they're very willing to talk to you actually and kind of, you know, see what the program has to offer. And so, but you do have to, wade through those that are just kicking the tires and those that actually have an idea that may go somewhere. But, you know, that's the other part of the ECI commitment. If the client can come up with the, you know, $7,500, $10,000, whatever it is, then normally they're committed to the process, you know,
right.
And that's a, you know, we offer a year long ride at that point. So typically you're kind of, you know, you're joined at the hip at that point.
$10,000 gets me some pretty decent access to you for the whole year?
Absolutely. And access, you know, we do.
Lee spends that on wine and a weekend.
That's chimichangas.
Yes, you know, it's amazing how many legal bills go way over at that $10,000 threshold.
Oh, and
pretty
a heartbeat.
Quick.
And yeah. Every time you call, at least in the old days, you call somebody and you just visualize that taxi meter.
Well, you just hear that.
Ka-ching.
Right. You know, and we do entrepreneur boot camps in a lot of our cities, you know, which is a full-day program where we bring in other service providers. And so, you know, anybody in the program can attend those. You know, we do law camps, you know, once a quarter where we have an entrepreneur kind of come and speak. So we're trying to inundate these clients with information to keep them on the path and from making mistakes.
Do you take equity in place of the 10 grand?
We have not, as a law firm, that, you know, involves some conflicts issues that get a little dicey with the size of our firm. You know, I think maybe there's some people that have, you know, they saw the golden egg, so they exit the firm and then do that. But within the confines of the firm, we're not able to do that right now. But what we have also done, speaking of equity, is we'll defer the $10,000. You know, for certain cases, we kind of take an equity piece because we loan them the money, if you will, and then they can pay it back when they get a certain level of funding. So,
well, and it sounds like you're taking some equity play anyway, because $10,000 is a loss leader to get them as a client.
You know, absolutely,
it's an investment.
It's an investment in the company, and you know, and we have to be very strategic on our side to you know, have a bank of information we can use and have associates that are really invested that can work on these projects. Because you can get upside down in a hurry. But you know, we're willing to plant a lot of seeds and see, you know, hopefully have a lot of them grow up to be good companies.
Now, do you have a track record of any results? Any of the companies that have gone through the program kind of grow, or do you feel like that's even, I know, part of in the legal profession, you want to be considered a trusted advisor. You want to be kind of a, I don't want to say a partner, but kind of a partner in their growth.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, again, law firm rules, we can't
name any names,
but yeah, we have had successes with, you know, the program's been around about 2 years. We haven't necessarily had any full exits, but we've had some substantial venture capital invested, which is what these entrepreneurs are really looking for, you know, first get in the door. So we've had a lot of success. I mean, and that's another reason to be out in the marketplace, is to meet these angel investors and meet these, you know, VC representatives.
But can you help them with those relationships?
We absolutely do. I mean, it's a lot of introductions.
Are you kidding me? This guy's word. He's at everything. Did you hear him?
I mean, you know, because obviously that's what those entrepreneurs are looking for typically, is access to capital. So we do what we can. I mean, we don't offer any assurances, but we'll certainly make some introductions.
So this ECI, though, there's this whole thought leadership dimension. You are generating and distributing thought leadership for these folks. And so that's part of what they get as participating in the ECI as well, yeah?
That's absolutely what we're trying to do, is really, you know, push that thinking forward and you know, and get them to be forward thinking is the key.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. What great work you're doing. So what's the best way for our listeners, many of whom, incidentally, are in startup mode?
Absolutely.
As we've discovered. What's the best way for them to reach out and learn more?
Yeah, the best way, you can check our website, which is bakerdonelson.com, and that's BakerDonelson.com, the not Donald Duck, as I say. or feel free to email me. I'm ccrosby@bakerdonelson.com as well, and love to talk to anybody that wants more information.
Well, thanks so much for coming to visit us. I tell you what would be fun, if it doesn't break the law rules, and we'll have to work our way through that. It might be a lot of fun, Lee, if you're up for this too, is to have you come back with a client and talk about the relationship and talk about the ECI or something, or maybe their experience in participating in the ECI.
Love to do that. Love to do that.
You think that'd
be a
good show?
Do you have somebody here locally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great.
All right. Book it, Dano.
we'll do that. I'll send another email.
All right. How about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Yeah, love to. Thanks, guys.
Yes, sir.
If he brings a client, does that mean he has to kill you afterwards?
Probably.
It is the law.
There's a lot of consent forms that have to be signed.
Next up on High Velocity Radio, we have with us the Grand Poobah of Pyramid Consulting, Maury Morgel. Welcome to the show, man.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I probably butchered that last name. How do we say your last name?
Margol.
Margol, okay.
You were in the ballpark.
You were close.
Yeah, they'd have gone right by it if I hadn't
mentioned. He's not the Grand Poobah. He might be the Grand Poobah of mobile.
Okay. He's the grand poobah of mobile for
yes,
Pyramid Consulting.
Our co-founders are getting a little scared with that at this point.
So, that was a coup.
So what's moving and shaking in mobile, man?
Everything. Mobile is where the web was 10 years ago. We're seeing exciting march here. Companies are deploying mobile quickly. They're saying, what is this mobile thing? We've got to be there. And it's no longer a nice to have. It's a have to have now.
Now, it sounds like people think it's a have to have, but it seems like they're just doing anything to get on a phone. Isn't it a have to have, but in the right way?
Yes. So, you know, here again, the internet all over again. Originally, it was get me a website.
Right.
I got to have a website.
Exactly.
It's a real
just
estate.
Take my brochure and then slap it on the web.
So we've seen some silly things on mobile where people are saying, get me a mobile app.
Right.
Like I talked to a major company recently, and they just had a locator where you could find one of their locations. And that's all their iPhone or their BlackBerry or their Android app did was you downloaded it and it would find a location. Kind of silly. But we're seeing that there's this massive transom now people are passing over, that it's no longer just get brochureware out on mobile. It's now generate revenue. And we're seeing companies that, especially in the hotel business, generating millions of dollars a month in bookings via mobile. So we're starting to see the ROI, whether it's B2C, business to consumer, where companies have developed mobile apps to sell hotel bookings or other items. A lot of retailers find that it drives in-store business, that people don't necessarily buy on their mobile, but they shop on their mobile and then they go in the store to pick it up. And we're seeing that B2E, which is business to employee, that all the employees now have mobile devices and businesses are finding ways to make the business more efficient. And then B2B, where companies are allowing companies they do business with to use mobile apps to tap into their systems.
So I'm fascinated by the career transition because you're a little longer in the tooth than some folks in the studio. And mobile didn't exist when you got started in your career. What did tell to us about how you got into mobile?
Well, I was actually, and thank you, I am one of the, other than...
You had to bring that up, right?
Than you, I have one of the gray hairs in the room, but, you know, but I do have a 10-year-old hair. It keeps me young, but... I started my career at IBM, and so I started in technology and then did the entrepreneurial thing and owned a few companies. And then I ended up, lo and behold, at Bell South. And when I was at Bell South, I saw wireless coming and decided that wireless is where I wanted to be. So I had a role there where I was in charge of Wi-Fi strategy and product development.
And what year was that?
This was 7-8 years ago. And I really saw that wireless was coming. And because of that, I co-founded an organization here with Steve Bachman called the Wireless Technology Forum. And we started that 8 years ago, and we've grown it to 650 members and a mailing list of 7,000. And we put on events every month. And the reason I founded that with Steve was he's a local angel investor and CEO for Hire. And I had breakfast with him one morning. I worked for him at a startup company. And I said, you know, I'm seeing all these super cool wireless things in the market. Like back then, it was dual mode devices where you could do wireless and Wi-Fi on a phone. WiMAX, which is now prevalent in the market. And nobody was seeing them. These were all in the lab at Bell South. And I said, you know, we need to start an organization to talk about this stuff. And he agreed. And I guess I just guessed right. So I left Bell South and went to a company that was calling on carriers. And I called on Singular, and I launched ringback tones, which are those things when you call someone, it says, please enjoy the music while your party's being reached.
Oh, that's you, huh?
Yeah, we launched that nationally with Singular, and then my career evolved along, and now I'm at Pyramid in charge of their mobile strategy and mobile practice. So what we do at Pyramid is two things. One is we develop mobile apps, and the other is we test mobile apps. There's a very large retailer here in town that launched 50,000 devices, now up to 60,000 in their stores, and we automated their testing. So they had 6 applications on those devices, and they had 22 testers in a room banging away. And we automated that and made things that took 4 weeks to test. We could do it overnight. So we've built a practice around that, and now we're working with HP to provide services on behalf of HP. And then on the development side, we work with native development, which for those of you who don't know what that means, native means that we code for Apple iPhones, we code for BlackBerry, we code for Android. All the popular programs, and then we use other programs such as PhoneGap and Cintia Touch, and we've now become a Roe Mobile certified developer. And those are tools that allow us to build the product once and deploy it and test it across multiple devices. So with Roe Mobile, we can write a mobile application one time, but deploy it across three or four different platforms.
You think I should go along with my BlackBerry playbook?
Well, I gotta be dreadfully honest here. I was a big fan of BlackBerry, and I was at a conference recently, and I have to give someone else credit because I didn't make this up, but they said BlackBerry users are like smokers. We know we have to quit. We just can't. And I had a side business where I was teaching executives how to use BlackBerries, and I did okay with that and produced webinars and seminars. And then BlackBerry had me come to BlackBerry World, and I had 275 people attend my session. So I'm a big BlackBerry fan. They give me free devices. I've had every device they've ever made. But I got to say, I was at this recent conference 3 weeks ago, and they've got a big, big mountain to climb, and I'm not sure how they're going
to
do it.
Well, it's a little bit of a mental shift to create products that you don't have to teach someone how to use, that your grandmother can use, right?
Well, and to be honest with you, I was asked by a client to produce iPhone and Android training as well, because they, you know, even though iOS claims it's so easy to use, there's a lot of double tapping and triple tapping and things. You know, the people at Apple told me the biggest problem they have is people come into the store and the phone is a brick because the person didn't understand you have to close an app once in a while. And even though they preach that the apps, once you tap the button, they stop working, but there's memory leaks and things like that. So, but you're right. I mean, BlackBerry's got a big hill to climb, and most of our clients.
We're never going to get a BlackBerry sponsorship, are we?
It's good effect.
As my brother would say, that train has sailed.
Yeah. But, you know, clients are more interested in Android and iPhone. And what's driven that, you know, taking, you know, my personal opinion off the table, when I was at BlackBerry World, one of their PR people came over to me and said, well, you know, so-and-so consulting firm says bring your own device to work, saves money. The other consulting firm says it doesn't save any money. Who's right? And I said, it doesn't matter. And she said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? And I said, the consumer will always win. And when I was at Bell South, I was in charge of Wi-Fi, and Bell South said, we have Ethernet ports every 3 feet. What do we need Wi-Fi for? People started bringing Wi-Fi routers to work because they wanted Wi-Fi. So in the end, they allowed us to do Wi-Fi. We saw that with PCs. Originally, we had green screens and, you know, 3270 emulation when I worked at IBM, and nobody cared about a PC. People started bringing them to work saying, why can't I do Excel at work? So it was consumer-driven, where the fax machine and PBX wasn't. So, you know, as soon as the CMO brought an iPhone in and said, why can't I get my corporate email on this? You know, we saw this movement to IT departments to allow iPhones and Androids. And that's what's fueling our business, is now these same IT departments are struggling, and startups struggle with this. How do I deploy code for all these platforms? So if you're an IT department, you're saying, how do I support iPhones and Androids and BlackBerries, and how do I write applications to satisfy my employees? And there is some cost savings with bring your own device to work, because the company doesn't have to spend $200 a device. But, you know, since we have the lawyer in the room, there's legal ramifications. And I actually, for one of my clients, I wrote some waivers and some policies, because I bring my Android to work. It's got all my cousin's wedding pictures on there, and then I lose it, and the company wants to wipe it remotely. And then all of a sudden I say, well, I'm going to sue you because you just wiped off all my wedding or my, you know, my vacation pictures to Rome. And, you know, now I have a claim against you. So there's things that the companies have to do to protect themselves. But at the end of the day, the employees want to use the devices they want to use and what they're comfortable with.
Now, the bottom line, you think every company should be having a mobile application? Like, that's like you alluded to it earlier, but is it really a must-have?
Well,
or you must have a mobile strategy, I would think. That's a must-have. Maybe the application, maybe not a must-have today.
Right. So what's happening is we're moving beyond voice and email on the mobile device. And people want their data anywhere they are at all times. So companies should take advantage of that. And what you said is key. They need a mobile strategy. They don't necessarily have to have a mobile app, but they need to start somewhere. And what we're hearing from our clients is that no matter what business they're in, mobile is transforming their business. So just like the internet transformed a lot of retail and a lot of travel, mobile is transforming businesses. So deliveries are getting there faster. People are able to track things that they couldn't track before. They can track their employees. Employees can get information they couldn't get to before. And so, you know, it's here again. How do you satisfy the customer and generate additional revenue by having the data where you need it?
Can you clear up the whole 4G, 3G, wanna be me thing? I don't. What's that about, and what kind of impact does it have on that?
At the Wireless Technology Forum, we called that the alphabet soup, and we were WTF before WTF. So, 3G, 4G. 3G stands for third generation network. 4G stands for fourth generation. We're just talking about speeds and feeds. So before 3G, we had 2G. And, you know, 3G approached DSL speeds that you might have or cable modem speeds at your house, like 1 meg across the pipe. Now when we get to 4G, all bets are off and we're getting, you know, 10, 20 megs on a cell phone. Now, this introduces a few problems. One is the same thing happened when I worked at Bell South and we came out with 3 meg and 6 meg DSL. The websites weren't prepared for this. So I was one of the first people to get 6 meg DSL in Atlanta because I was on a trial. And I thought, wow, I can't wait to get on and surf. And it was really disappointing because the content players weren't sending the data out that quickly yet. So So there's always this lag between.
It's like driving a Ferrari in traffic. Right?
Exactly. That's a great analogy. So now we've got these 4G devices and the networks are prepared for it this time and the content providers. But 4G, you get tremendous speeds, so you no longer have any latency. The issues are battery life now, and it just really chews up your battery because to power all that, you have to have a lot of battery power.
Now, what about the content? I mean, you see commercials now. I saw one yesterday, I think, about for Wimbledon. Like they're watching Wimbledon on a phone, right? And I can barely see the ball on my television. Now, how much data has to go through there for me to watch live tennis on my phone?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And, you know, it has to be a lot of data, and it's very difficult to watch. But we're seeing all these accessories. There's now a phone that has a projector built into it that you can project on the back of a seat on an airline flight or on the wall.
Sweet.
It's an LG device. It didn't get a lot of play in the market. Also, if you go into the wireless stores, they have a device that looks like a phone, but it's a projector. So this is where the future is headed. And there will be docking stations where you can dock your phone. You know, I talked to the guy that cut my hair yesterday. He said that he doesn't subscribe to cable or anything anymore.
Right, like Hulu and Netflix and all those.
Right, so he uses Hulu and Netflix. So for him, you know, if he had something he could bring his phone home and put it in a docking station and it shows on his big screen TV, he'd be quite happy. A lot of people are using their smartphones now as their own only internet connection. It's kind of what they were doing in Japan 5-6 years ago, because landline internet was so expensive over there. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of blue collar workers, a lot of lower income people, they get an iPhone or an Android or a BlackBerry device and it becomes their web surfing tool. So it'll just be a matter of time before people will connect something that will allow you to put that on a big screen.
So now that's the future then. People used to think, oh, my computer is going to be that central device, but it's really now going to be the phone is going to be that central device for most people?
Well, we're seeing the movement to tablets. And, you know, Steve Jobs always said that the tablet is not a PC replacement, but we're now seeing the Microsoft announcement with the Surface tablet that the cover has a keyboard built in and they have a desktop, you know, experience on there. So we will see a blurring between, and now we're seeing laptops that are razor thin that started with the MacBook Air. And so there's going to be this blurring. We've got, you know, these phones that are almost the size of a tablet. We have 7-inch tablets. We have 10-inch tablets. We have tablets that become PCs. So there'll be, you know, it's great for the consumer because they have so much choice.
Right.
But the key to all this is wireless. No one would care if we didn't have Wi-Fi and we didn't have 3 and 4G speeds because these devices would be boat anchors. So it's all tied back to wireless and it's all tied back to consumers and enterprises can do so much more with the wireless. I mean, watching TV may not be a great use of it, but, you know, it's kind of like listening to TV in your car on satellite radio. It's not the greatest experience, but if you want to follow along and see who's winning at Wimbledon, you can still do it.
You know? Now, do you think that from a government standpoint that there would be value in creating some kind of more robust Wi-Fi system throughout the country so that there was Wi-Fi everywhere?
Well, it's happening without the government and...
market by market.
Yeah, I like that strategy better. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a whole nother show. But when I worked at Bell South, I was on all these panels to talk about government Wi-Fi because all these municipalities wanted to Wi-Fi the city. And they thought, we used to joke internally that they thought it would cure cancer and cure literacy. And where it really helps is public safety. Because our policemen, our firemen, our ambulance drivers, they need to have all that information at their fingertips. And so, but with 4G speeds, you really don't have to. And the 4G networks are so good now and they're so ubiquitous that they really don't need the Wi-Fi. And there's this change that's happened. When I was at Bell South, they tried to push Wi-Fi as a network replacement and these dual mode phones because the wireline people wanted to keep their jobs. Now the carriers are all deploying tremendous amounts of Wi-Fi to get you off of their 3G and 4G networks.
I thought that's what they're complaining about. There's too much data going through the 4G and 3G networks.
So they have an impetus now to deploy Wi-Fi more and more and more, and they've set the devices up where you hit a Wi-Fi hotspot that they own. It'll ask you if you want to jump on it. So that's a good thing. It's going to be interesting to see now that Apple allows you to do FaceTime on 3G and 4G versus Wi-Fi only, what it does further to the network. But, you know, those are all things. And I used to tell people that what will happen in the future is the phone will pick the best network. That people didn't even realize that Bell South still made money on ship-to-shore telegraph in Brunswick, Georgia. It was in our annual report. And so people would say to me, wow, with Wi-Fi, what do we need 3G for? Or with 4G, what do we need Wi-Fi? But all these networks have their place.
So what exactly is your sweet spot in the market? And, you know, what kind of companies are you trying to reach? And how can they reach you?
Okay. So our sweet spot is enterprise customers. We do deal with some startups that are funded. And we do a couple of things in the app space that's different. What you're finding, if you go out and say, I want to build an iPhone app or an Android app, you generally find some independent guys who will come in and build the app for you. There's not a lot of boutique firms out there. There's only a couple. We're an IT services firm. We've been around 16 years, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. We have customers such as AT&T and UPS and others that I probably shouldn't name, but
the lawyer's nodding his head up.
Yeah, our differential is that we can do end to end. So we not only do the development, but we can do the testing, and we can do native code as well as the MEEPs, and we have the experience building these enterprise apps, and we can also do some of the strategy, just like. You were saying with legal, you can introduce people to VCs. And, you know, we have a bench that includes UI and UX people to design the app. We have coders who can code the app. We also have a very attractive pricing model as well because we do a blended model of onshore and offshore. So we have an offshore development center in India, and the rates there are a lot better. We also run a 24/7 shop over there. So like for testing, for instance, we have customers who maybe they build it internally or they want us to build it. When the guys here shove off at 6 o'clock at night, the code gets sent to India, it gets tested all night, and then they come in the next morning and they show them where the bugs are. So those are some of the competitive advantages that we have. And as far as contacting me, our website is Pyramid CI for Consulting Inc. So pyramidci.com. And my email is very simple. It's Maury, M-A-U-R-Y, .Margol, M-A-R-G-O-L, @pyramidci.com.
Now, you mentioned that the Wireless Technology Forum does monthly events. Mm-hmm. Is that, you want to give a plug for that?
Sure. So if you go to wirelesstechnologyforum.org, we tried to find a longer URL, but it wasn't available. We put on monthly events, and it's $25 for a guest or $95 for the year. And as one of my bosses used to say, cheap at twice the price. And we also we have a startup corner at every event where we showcase wireless startups. And we generally, we have four or five folks on a panel to talk about topics in the wireless space. So we bring subject matter experts in.
On a monthly basis?
Yes. So it's the third Thursday of the month.
Uh-huh.
And we just had Glenn Laurie, who's president of Emerging Devices at AT&T. He just came in and spoke about the M2M space, which is a whole nother wireless space, the machine-to-machine or mobile-to-mobile space. And we had someone on from Numerex, which is headquartered here locally. So those are the kind of events we put on. Also, I'd like to give a plug for the Metro Atlanta Chamber. We are working with them, Wireless Technology Forum, to try to, this is something that I came up with 4 or 5 years ago, and now the Chamber's jumped on it, try to make Georgia the wireless state. We've tried to be the nanotech state and the biotech state, and we have an opportunity here to showcase all of the tremendous companies. We've got, you know, the iPhone, all the stuff is headquartered here for AT&T, AT&T Mobility. We've got C-Beyond, I mean, Numerex. We've got, you know, so many wireless plays. We've got the largest tower builder in the country, an Israeli company that's headquartered here in Atlanta. So when you go down the list, we have tremendous assets here in the wireless space, and now we're going to promote that. So there's, you know, the Chamber is leading that. If somebody wants to get involved, they can contact me and I can put them in touch with the Chamber. But
so you're affiliated with the Chamber, their initiative as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. So let's make sure then that we leave them one more time with your personal contact information.
Sure. So it's Maury, M-A-U-R-Y, .Margol, M-A-R-G-O-L, at pyramidci.com.
Nicely done, sir. Can you hang out with us while we visit with our last guest?
Absolutely.
The all pressure's right. on him, man.
Lee, it's the moment we've all been waiting for. It's the undercard. We're done with the undercard. We're now hit the headliner. We now have with us the founder of an organization called Social Vest, Mr. Adam Ross. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
You've been very patient. You've been polite.
I've been learning a lot.
You've been taking copious notes. That's terrific.
You got to stay in front of the mic. That's the first note that you missed.
I'm sorry about that. Uncomfortably close to the microphone.
Social Vest, cool logo, cool business card, equally compelling name. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So what Social Vest is we're a program that allows people to earn money for the cause they care about while shopping.
Can I do it wirelessly? That's all I care about.
We got a mobile app.
It's gotta be
we
mobile.
Have to be on mobile. So we have a mobile app, actually, for iPhone. Actually just got approval in the App Store last week.
Good stuff. So how does it work?
So it's super easy, right? So right now we have three ways you can shop and earn. So you can shop. We have a website you can come to. We have browser applications you can install on your desktop, or we have an iPhone app. If you use our browser apps, which are our most popular sort of way of interacting, you install the plugins, you run them one time. You go to Best Buy, you shop, you earn 3%. You go to Amazon, you shop, you earn 4%. All this stuff happens in the background. The money just adds up in your account. And from there, you decide who you want to give it to, when you want to give it, and how much you want to give. So
can I give it to my child's college fund?
You cannot give it to your child's college fund right now.
Can you give it to my child's college
fund? You can give it to Stones, however. We can all give to Stones. No, you can give to any 501c3 in the country, over 1.5 million of them. You can give to Austin's baseball team, likely. You can give to your local Humane Society, your religious organization, whatever it is. Colleges, there is a program out there for people to do that, but we are not that one.
So what compelled you to go down this path? You surely entertain the idea of a real job at some point.
No, that was for suckers. No. So I had a sort of strange background, but wound up in a bunch of different entrepreneurial opportunities and got involved with a lot of nonprofits. And every year you'd see nonprofit organizations put their hands out for, you know, they needed $1 million or $500,000. Or I was working with one locally who had a good relationship with, you know, Target and Home Depot and all these guys. And it was, you know, this is what we're doing for the next year. We need $1 million, right? But at the same time, they interact with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So could you create a more meaningful relationship between consumers and nonprofits and retailers by tying them together? And so that's what we tried to do, is say, like, how do we make this a win-win-win for everyone?
So walk me through this. I get home this afternoon. Yep. I tell my wife, Holly, hey, I met this guy with Social Vest. We ought to do this thing. We go to a website.
Yep.
And we do what?
There's two things you can do. So you go to the website. On the top, there's something that says, well, depending on, we're doing some A-B testing right now. So you're either going to get served a page right on the front that says, click here to activate the browser app. It'll run you through a quick setup process, and you're good to go. Literally, the setup process could be that you sign up with Facebook or you enter your, you know, email address, and I think it's email address. Joy's over here. I think just email address and maybe zip code.
And just to be clear, I could have gone home and done this, or I could have done it
on your iPhone.
On
yeah,
your iPhone.
Yeah, we're in the App Store now, so you can download the Socialist app. And once you set up the browser app on your computer, there's also a link up at the top that says browser app. Once you set those up, again, it sits kind of in the background. And whenever you go to one of our participating merchants, there's, you know, over 600 of them.
All right, but when you say set it up, have I got to tie a credit card to it?
No credit card. Doesn't cost you anything. Literally, the setup is, depending on your browser, Chrome. We work with Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, and Safari. And it literally is you download the thing. It installs into your browser and kind of it just kind of hangs out. And what happens is when you go to, from then on, we tie it back to you as a user. So we have Stone's account. You've now created your account your money can come into. And when you go to Best Buy, you don't want to replace that iPhone case because it's got that sticker on the back. But when you go buy...
I was in Best Buy the other day, though. I'm looking at laptops.
Yeah, and we were talking about, Mario was talking about I think it was Mario talking about buying on your phone and picking up in store, right? You could do that too at Best Buy. But you need to go buy a laptop. You're on BestBuy.com. You picked out the laptop you want. If you want to pick it up in store, great. You can do that. If you want to have it shipped to you, great. You can do that.
Right.
Once you've made that purchase, I think at Best Buy it's 3% comes back to your account. So you spend $1,000, you got $30 into your account to give to whatever nonprofit you want.
And I can let it pile up. I don't have to hurry up and disperse that $30. I can let it pile up and look like a hero when it's $300.
That's exactly right. That's
I'm
exactly
liking
right.
it.
Yeah, so you buy a laptop, you buy an iPhone case, you buy, Austin needs a new baseball glove, you can go to Dick's.com. You know, literally everything you buy, there's an opportunity for you to earn. And that was what we really wanted to achieve. I mean, Amazon was one of our partners, so... You know, we find ourselves buying everything on Amazon these days because, like, it's super easy. If you're a Prime member, it's free shipping. You get it in 2 days. It's faster for me to often do that than, like, wait on either me or my wife to get to the grocery store to do something. So you shop, you earn, adds up, and then you choose kind of where you want. You give to one organization, 10 organizations, $5, $10, whatever you want.
So go ahead, Maury.
So what is your revenue model? Do you take a slice of this?
Yeah, so we make money based on sales. So let's say the Amazon gets 4% for a consumer, we take a margin above and beyond that 4%. So 100% of the 4% goes to the nonprofit. So so we're basically driving revenue off spend.
And what separates you? There's a lot of people doing this in the space. There's a lot of social gifting these days. Social gifting seems to be one of the hottest things, and they allow people to give money. I know there's a company out of Scandinavia that sort of invented the whole thing. So what separates your app from the others?
Sure. So there's a few things. So there's a handful of people out there who do earn for a cause. What kind of makes us different is this accruing account model, right? So it's effectively a savings account. So the money kind of piles up. I give it to who I want when I want. The other pieces that are different is we've got a lot of social integration, which a lot of people don't have. So and this makes sense from a retailer perspective as well as from a consumer perspective. But if I go to shop at Amazon, I want to share that with my friends that I'm earning money by shopping at Amazon because we can all get together around a cause, right? What I'm not likely to get, like, to post to my Facebook wall is like, hey, I earned $5 back by shopping at some place, right? So we're really trying to drive consumer loyalty through a social play. And so when I make a purchase, it pushes to my social feeds, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. If I make a donation, it pushes to my social feeds. We also have created, they're going to be released next week. We've got fundraisers that you can actually get together with your friends. So now this idea of micro philanthropy of, you know, my $5 adds up. So, you know, the five of us in the room, if we each had $10, we could give $50, right? So, like, integrating the social piece with the giving piece. And then the next piece that we want to do is try and take it to the offline world, brick and mortar retail. So again, we've got the browser apps we talked about. We have the iPhone app, which does you can search for products, you can search for stores, you can also do price comparison search. So it's the red laser, if you will, of good. So if I want to find a price on, again, I want to buy an iPhone case, I'm in Best Buy, I can run a price scan on it. I can be like, oh, I can get it at J&R, I can get it at Best Buy. If it's the same price, I'm going to buy it from the one that's giving me the most money back. So those are all things that I don't think any of our competitors do. And then in the brick-and-mortar world, what we're trying to do is have it so you can walk into your local, whether it's shoe store or restaurant or whatever, and have a piece of that come back into your account as well.
And so who's your ultimate customer these days? Are you going after the Amazons of the world, or are you going after me as a consumer so that I'll bring my friends into the play. Which end of the market are you trying to generate the most eyeballs from?
Yes. No, so the answer is both, right? So we're creating partnerships with nonprofit organizations, both large and small, from, you know, again, local humane societies to, I can't really talk about some of the bigger ones we're working on, but they're national organizations that you would all know and have, you know, millions of supporters. We're also going after the big guys on the retail side as well. So I can't say again specifically who on the retail side, but people like, you know, Target, Home Depot, Saks, Bloomingdale's. And then we're also looking sort of at a more local level. How do we get like local networks built of retailers? So, you know, there's a lot of talk about, and I'm friends with some of the guys who have these companies, but the Daily Deal guys, right? So they initially started and was like, oh, it's a great loyalty play. It's a terrible loyalty play because what I'm really doing is I'm looking for the best deal every time out there, right? So I want to get a haircut. Oh, well, here's 50% off of this place. All right, I tried that one. I'm going to go to the next one, right? So our model is, don't give me 50% off, which generally costs people 75%, right, as a retailer, right? But give me 4%. Don't give it to me. Retailers typically don't like giving money back to a consumer, saying, like, here's $5 for coming to shop with us. It just leaves a bad taste in their mouth. So the idea is, give 4%. It's going to make the world a better place. And by the way, it's not just that it feels good. It's that it actually drives revenue, so, right? So people overwhelmingly will choose one store over another based on a cause, right? So if price and quality being equal, I can't charge you three times as much. I can't be 10 times further. I can't, you know, within reason, if and especially the millennials and younger generations, if I, there's a company, we can talk about Tom's or Warby Parker or any of these guys that have a cause ingrained in their business, they outperform the market. So for us, it's not only does it feel good, but it actually drives revenue. And so the answer to the question is both, right? We need consumers without, and it's also this chicken or the egg sort of proposition, right? So without a retail offering, how do you drive members? And without members, how do you drive retailers to engage? And so those are the challenges we solve every day. So,
now, is that the biggest challenge for you as a founder of a startup?
It's one of the many, right? There are quite a few challenges out there. I think the biggest challenge is time, right? So time and money, I think, are the two biggest challenges. You can solve anything with enough of those two things, right?
So are you looking for money? Are you?
We are not right now looking for money. We're fortunate enough that we raised some money.
What about legal services?
We're fortunate enough we have some legal services as well, but it sounds like a great program that Clint has. You know.
Actually, we orchestrated this whole thing to get you and Clint in the room.
Perfect. Hey, wait a minute. What about mobile development?
What about mobile development?
It's a perfect storm of opportunity here. But
and testing. Someone's got to test
somebody
that.
Somebody does have to test it. We just throw them right out there. Apple just approved them. But I mean, it's funny because a lot, obviously, it's orchestrated. But the, you know, the offering that Clint does have is something that when we founded our business would have been appealing to us. I mean, you know, speaking candidly, we spent more than 10 grand on all that stuff. And it wasn't necessarily an organized strategy. Yeah. And so Mari's too big for us, but having a reliable development team is huge. And we were fortunate that we have a really strong development group here that we work with. But time and money, you know, everything takes three times longer, costs three times as much, and you need to get it done in half the time. And if you don't, somebody else will, or you run out of the other two things. So those are probably the biggest challenges.
So what's the priority right now? What can we do to help? You need to meet a certain type of person. You need to hire more people.
What's most helpful is we want to get the word out there about like how easy it is to do this, right? When you explain it to somebody, they're kind of like, why wouldn't I do that, right? And I think that's the natural thing. So number one is we want to get people to sort of share the word about kind of how easy it is. And you know, we what we really enjoy is when people sign up and they use it. And like that first time you give the money you earn, even if it's like $10, right?
It feels good,
right?
Though, right?
It feels really good that you're like, wow, I had to buy. We had a girl, Brooke, who works for us, her boyfriend had to buy something, and he got like his first $10 in his account. And I don't think he was that excited about the idea until it actually got there, and it was only $10, right? But he was like, wow, that was like really great. So having that experience is good. So we want to get people to have that experience of like the feeling of giving something based on stuff you have to buy anyway. We're not saying go buy more crap that you don't need. What we're saying is when you're buying crap, buy it smarter. And then, you know,
that's like, a good tagline.
You should put that on the brochures.
Buy your crap smarter. Can I say that on the radio?
You can now.
Is there a button somewhere? And then the other thing is, you know, from a local business perspective, we are, like I said, looking to build this local network of.
Are you starting here in Atlanta?
We are founded here in Atlanta.
But is that we're going to start this local network thing?
Yeah, we are. We're going to focus on local stores. I mean, there are a couple big, you know, national retailers we're talking to. But yeah, we would like to start in Atlanta, finding, you know, companies that believe in what we're doing.
So retail establishments that believe in what you're doing, they want to kind of have the social cause
component. And you know, and really learn with us this.
Would restaurants be the, would that work for you?
Restaurants are a great opportunity for us. You know, anybody from, you know, restaurants, again, shoe stores, clothing stores, places that people are shopping on a daily basis. Uh-huh. And again, we're not asking for 20% of sales. We're not asking for 50% of sales. We're talking about small dollars here.
Right.
But over time, these dollars add up, and they're ultimately giving back to the community. And you know, if you look at even like local stores, you know, Fabric, I think, has, which is a clothing store, has a nonprofit they're associated with. You know, Target on the other end of the spectrum has, you know, they give to education.
They give back, right? In our community.
Yeah, but what they do typically is, you know, or Home Depot, for example, does a lot with Habitat, right? But maybe that doesn't mean anything to you. And particularly as you get younger, like how does what, you know, what a brand does resonate with me as a consumer?
Right.
How does that engender loyalty? And how does that get me to spread that loyalty around to my friends? And really the most authentic and effective way to do that is by engaging with me on a personal level.
And let you do with the money what you want.
Exactly. And you know, when we do these social pushes and when a consumer opts in to say, hey, let me tell my friends about what I'm earning, and it pushes to my Facebook feed, that's 400% more effective than paid advertising, right? And you can't buy that space. It's not available for sale, right?
Because I know when Amazon says, hey, do you want to share that you just bought this new razor blade? Right. And you're like, no, I don't want to share that at all.
Right. <You know? laughs> Right.
But if it said, hey, I spent money at this store and I donated whatever, $1.35 to whatever charity.
But even better for him, because you get to say $30 or whatever, because this accumulation thing, that's not anything to dismiss. That's an important aspect.
No, it is. It is. It's something we're excited about. Again, the idea is like, you know, some people might say, well, you know, I spent $10, I got 50 cents. Well, that's true. But over the course of the year, what the average person spends online adds up to real money. And let's say it's, you know, somebody talked about education, I think. And, you know, there's a arguably competitor, not really competitor, but you know, U-Promise out there, I'm sure you guys are familiar with, but U-Promise, you know, they have 13 million consumers, but at the end of the day, the average person who uses U-Promise, like, super effectively, and, you know, I'm saying this sort of off the cuff here, but let's say they earn $300 a year, right? In 18 years, call it 20 years, right, that's, what, $6,000, and that's on the high end of what somebody's going to earn. And in 18 years, the average cost of education is going to be something on the order of like $200,000 or something like that, right? So when you look at, it's going to take me 18 years to earn $6,000 against $200,000 of education, it's a really long horizon for an arguably nominal return. Now, if we take that $300 and you apply it to cause, what we're not going to all get together and do is give to Stone's kids' education, right? Like, that would be meaningful. If the five of us here were giving $1,500 a year to Stone's kids' education, that's,
you know,
that's
that an oral contract is binding, right?
right.
I have a lawyer here.
Perfect. So, but if you were to take that and apply it to cause, the Humane Society, whatever it is, and let's say we have $300 and we all say, oh, you know, we're doing a ride for cancer this weekend, give me $50. It's not taking all of your money. It's taking a piece of your account that's accruing, right? Now we're taking the social effect. So if I have 100 friends and they all give me $50, I just raised $5,000. Nobody had to come out of pocket to do it. And really the way this kind of started was when I was on Facebook and, you know, literally every day, especially, you know, this time of year, there's a walk, a run, a bike, a something for cancer, diabetes, something, you know, and these are all things that you want to support, right? Stop child trafficking, stop, you know, there's a million causes out there and I want to help all my friends and all these causes are meaningful. But, and you know, but how many times do you want to reach into your pocket and say, here's another $20, here's another $50?
How many 20s you have?
Yeah, right. It just kind of wears on you. And so the idea of having this account where you can just reach into.
Right.
And again, if what's nice on the social side is even if I give $10, but I have 100 friends who have these accounts, I just raised $1,000, which is a meaningful number.
Well, I think it's a fantastic concept. And just to be clear, after participating in today's show, I'm not sending mine to college. I'm sending them to startup school.
Right. That's it.
Considerably less investment on the front end. And I think probably much better return. So let's make sure that our listeners know how to reach out and learn more about Social Vest.
Sure. So you can learn more at www.socialvest.us.
And the App Store on the iPhone, you can go to Social Vest too.
Yep, you can look up Social Vest on the App Store, and you can contact me at adamr@socialvest.us.
There's a lot of Adams in your organization?
There are lots of Adams. There are lots of Adams. Seven Adams, actually.
Good.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton, Lee Cantor, our guests this morning, Clint Crosby, Maury Margol, Adam Ross, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family, saying we'll see you in the fast lane.